Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Alison Russell is a multi-talented musician, storyteller, poet, and writer currently based in Nashville, Tennessee. Originally from Montreal, Quebec, Russell fled child and sexual abuse in her home by moving to Vancouver, British Columbia, and eventually taking solace in artistic expressions like music. Over the past 20 years, Russell has been a key member in bands like Poe Girl, Birds of Chicago, and Our Native Daughters, all of whom toured hard and gained loyal followings for their acclaimed records and live performances. On May 21st, 2021, Russell's first solo album was released by Fantasy Records. It's called Outside Child, and to say it's been a breakthrough record feels like an understatement. On top of making many critics' and fans' best of the year lists, the album led Russell to perform at the Grand Ole Opry for the first time, to perform on late-night talk shows like Jimmy Kimmel Live and The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and it was nominated for 3 Grammy Awards, which will be awarded on April 3rd, 2022. Having crossed paths over the years in Guelph at the Hillside Festival, Allison and I connected recently for our first ever in-depth conversation where we discussed her family history and her resolve to be a proud survivor of abuse, how Montreal protected her, our collective reckoning with white supremacy and the tyranny of violence towards women, the inspiring work and music of Brandi Carlile, Allison's current work on a memoir, how her experiences informed the wondrous songs on Outside Child and what the Grammys mean to her, future plans, and much more. a part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. With additional support from Blackbird Music, which is a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and a friendly staff who will help you with all of your music buying needs. You can learn more about them at blackbird.ca. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 668 of Creative Control, featuring the inspiring and talented Allison Russell with your host, me, Vish Khanna. What the heck could they bring to stop me, Lord? Nothing from the earth, nothing from the sea, not a God Almighty thing. I'm a midnight ride, storm bona fide, not flying. I'm an angel of the morning too. The promise that the dawn will bring you, you, you. Hi, Allison. How are you?
Hello, I'm doing very well, Vish. How are you?
I'm well. Nice to see you again. I don't know if you know this, but we have had encounters at the Hillside Festival when I lived in Guelph.
I remember. I remember you well.
Oh, good. I must have introduced your band, Birds of Chicago, at some point, right?
You did. And okay. I think you actually might have introduced Poe Girl as well. And I have a distinct memory of standing with you and listening to the Bourbon Tabernacle Choir and Kate Fenner singing, and both of us being like, this is so wonderful. We get to hear Kate Fenner again. So I have a really distinct memory of that. Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. I was putting that out there and I didn't know what was going to come back. You could have said, yeah, I'm sorry, pal. I don't remember you at all.
No,
but that's lovely.
Of course I remember you. Of course
it's nice. Well, it's very nice to connect again and under very wonderful circumstances. And we're going to talk about the year you've been having already in a moment. But as I always do, first of all, where in the world are you today?
So today I am in Los Angeles, California. I'm at a hotel called the Sunset Marquee, and I'm here working on my book and also doing some co-writing sessions and some promo stuff and meeting with my music publisher, Concord Music Publishing, here as well.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah, so that's where I am today.
Business trip. But now I know you as being from Montreal, but where are you living these days?
Yeah. So for the last 5 years, I am one of the many members of the Canadian invasion taking over Nashville. My partner JT Nero and our daughter Ida and I have been living in Nashville for the last almost 5 years now. But we go back and forth a lot. You know, I actually have a lot of family in Vancouver, BC, and a lot of family in sort of throughout the prairies, but also I just recently connected with my biological father and that side of my family, and they are just outside of Toronto in Brampton. So I come to Ontario a lot as well when it's not the pandemic.
Oh, that's lovely. Has it been a happy reconnection there?
Very, very much. Yeah, it's been good. I didn't know him at all growing up. And so it's been, and I didn't have the best of luck with my adoptive father. So I'm very grateful to be connected now with my biological father. And I have two siblings on that side as well and a wonderful stepmother. So that's been very joyful.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. And congratulations. I guess unhappily or happily, we will delve into some of your family history in just a moment. I say happily because I feel like you've been able to transcend the pain, and we will get into that on some level. I'm speculating, of course. But you mentioned the invasion, the Canadian invasion of Nashville. I missed the call for that invasion, I guess. So what prompted
it's
you?
It's never too late. It's never too late. You're welcome anytime.
I've been to Nashville. I like Nashville. What prompted your own thought of going to Nashville in particular to work on music and whatnot?
Well, you know, I'm really excited about the sort of creative expansion and inclusion and diversity of the kind of greater all Americana scene. And when I talk about Americana, I'm talking about all of the musical sort of roots, foundational influences of modern music. And that encompasses, you know, from the Caribbean up through South America, Central America, Mexico, the US, Canada. Like, I mean, all of it. And I've just been really galvanized and embraced by that community. Birds were, and Poe Girl was in the early days. And we just were drawn more and more to Nashville for work. And, you know, not on Music Row. We're very much outside of the mainstream, you know, country world. But there's so much more going on in Nashville than that.
Yeah.
And we just had this wonderful community of friends there, folks like Abigail Washburn and Bela Fleck and Ruth Moody and Jamie Dick, who plays drums on my record, and his wife, Ali Sperry, who's a beautiful writer. Rhiannon Giddens was living there at the time. She's now in Ireland. Mm-hmm. But she actually, part of the reason we ended up moving there was she, while she was on that Nashville show, bought a house. And we were roommates for a while, that when we first moved there, and our children are, you know, they call themselves, you know, tour siblings. So
oh, nice.
They've kind of grown up on the road together. And so it was just a really strong sense of community. My chosen sister Yola has wound up there. My other chosen sister Amethyst Kia, who's also in Our Native Daughters with Rhiannon Giddens and Layla McCalla and I, is in and out. She's in Johnson City, Tennessee, but she comes to Nashville all the time. And, you know, it just felt like a great community. And also, I, as a working musician mom, I wanted to be in a community that was understanding about artist families. And, you know, it was all the things you didn't have to say and all the things you don't have to explain to the school. And just that nobody is constantly saying, when are you going to get a real job there? People understand that songwriting and creative work and being an artist is a real job, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think we got a little bit weary. We had been in the greater sort of Chicago area when our daughter was born, and we were on the road, you know, we were just on the road like 250, 300 days of the year. And we realized as Ida was, we moved there when she was about to be 4 years old. And we were thinking about school. We were thinking about how can we keep doing our creative work, but also make sure that we're centering our daughter's needs.
Yeah.
You know.
So Nashville made sense on that level. Mm-hmm. I know you had a tremendously traumatic and difficult time coming up in Montreal. I know you ostensibly fled to Vancouver at some point. Did you find that you could galvanize, or rather be part of a galvanized musical community in either of those cities? Again, I know personally it must have been very difficult for you even ponder such things, but did you feel like connected to musical communities in those cities?
Very much. I mean, I credit so much of my debut solo album, Outside Child, is really a love song to Montreal and a song of gratitude to Montreal, because the art at the heart of that city sustained me and helped me survive. You know, it was a lifeline, and it was everything from being able to hear Oscar Peterson play for free at the Jazz Fest when I was a kid, you know, to when I moved into my first apartment with some women that I went to high school with. You know, we were all between the ages of sort of 15 and 17. We lived down the road, a few houses down from Lhasa de Sela, and I remember hearing her on her porch, you know, playing music. And I just feel like that between Carabana and the Montreal Jazz Fest, and my grandma taught at McGill, so I would go all the time and just hide out and listen to the conservatory students practicing. And I was surrounded by art. I was sustained by art in our city, all of our wonderful public libraries. I mean, I spent just hours and hours and hours of my childhood in, you know, running around Westmount Park and at the Westmount Public Library after school, because I went to Roslyn, which is in that neighborhood, for my primary school. And that, I just have so many memories. Free Shakespeare in the Park, the Repercussion Theater would do these incredible productions where you would follow the scenes, the audience would travel to different locations in the park and they would stage different scenes. I have such a strong memory of of experiencing Midsummer Night's Dream for the first time that way. I mean, I was just nourished by that city. And when I ran away at 15, I was relatively safe because there were 24-hour cafes. I would go play chess all night in these cafes. I would sleep in the graveyard and no one ever bothered me there. I would, you know, I'm grateful to that city. And that's definitely where my artist awakening began. But it wasn't until I moved to Vancouver when I was 17, about to be 18, that I really got immersed in a musical scene. And that was by the grace of my maternal aunt, Janet Lillian Russell, who is a brilliant songwriter and singer. And she really welcomed me into her kind of folky circle. And I, you know, everyone was 30 to 40 years older than me, but in her circle, but they just welcomed me so generously and encouraged my early songwriting. And I connected with, you know, eventually connected with Trish Klein, and we started Po Girl together. And, you know, the Biga Tanyas were so inspirational to me. Mm-hmm. As I remember when, you know, Trish and Frazee and Sam are all a few years older than I am. So I really looked up to them, and it was exciting to see them making it happen, going on their first tour and, you know, being kind of embraced by the, at the time, I guess, what was called the alt country community, what we would now call, you know, part of the greater Americana community. But so definitely I felt very much a part of the kind of folk revival, all Americana community forming in Vancouver. And that was really where I cut my teeth as an artist and stepped into my calling as a writer and a songwriter. And I realized I'll never forget the being invited to play our first Vancouver Folk Music Festival in 2003. And Po Girl was just, you know, brand new baby band.
Yeah.
And it was Doug Simpson who was programming at the time at Vancouver. And he put us on a stage with Odetta and Ani DeFranco and Utah Phillips and Martin Joseph. And I was like, I just want to do this for the rest of my life. I never want to do anything else.
That's lovely. So, it's very lovely. And I appreciate that you've cited some musical influences and inspirations and, you know, these things are come about by way of luck, talent, happenstance, and it sounds like you had that. The opening song on Outside Child is Montreal, and it was interesting to hear you talk about how you felt like you owed that city some debt of gratitude. Because as one delves into the songs on this record, you seem to be singing a lot about protectors. Montreal as a city protected you. Characters like Persephone protected you. Can you, and this is where I guess it'll get difficult potentially, but can you talk, and I know you've done this probably a lot with this record release, can you please, in your own words and as much as you want to divulge, talk about what you needed protection from and where you're at with that now? Having exercised so much with these beautiful songs, I imagine this has been helpful and therapeutic and all those sorts of things, but before we get to that, can we talk about what it is you're singing about, what you're addressing, and what people and cities needed to protect you from?
Yeah. Well, I was, you know, I was a child who was severely sexually and physically and psychologically abused. My primary abuser was my mother's husband, who was first my stepfather and then eventually adopted me. So he is actually legally my adoptive father to this day. He was an American expat who came up to Montreal in the 70s, and he brought a lot of dysfunction with him. He was born in 1936 in a sundown town in Indiana. And for those of you listening who don't know what a sundown town is, they were towns and counties in the United States where it was illegal for a person of color or a black person specifically to spend the night in the town. That was the level of intense white supremacy and bigotry and racism was such that a person of color couldn't spend the night. And if you did, it was legally allowable to lynch that person. So that's, you know, he came from, I believe that kind of indoctrination into violent ideologies white supremacist ideologies like that. I believe that is a form of child abuse. And he was subjected to that by his country and his town. You know, he grew up believing that black folks were three-fifths human, really believing that. And that was enshrined in the Constitution of the United States for a very, very long time. And he grew up in a town that believed black people were less than human. And he was raised by a mother who was severely abusive to him. So when he came to Montreal, he brought all of that with him. And he met my mother and I when I think I was not quite 2 years old yet. And my mom was very young. She was a child herself when she had me, 17, 18 years old. And she was struggling with mental undiagnosed schizophrenia. She wasn't diagnosed until many years later. And she was, unfortunately, at the time, you know, in Montreal, I was born in 1979. And so at this point, it's 81. And the trend in social services at that time was to just remove children and place them in foster care. And, you know, she wasn't given any therapy. She wasn't given any guidance or counseling or treatment or anything. You know, I was just taken from her, and she felt already shamed as, you know, an unwed mother, as a white mother with a black child. That was the stigma of that was very intense in Quebec of the early 80s. You know, the segregation in that city is intense and real to this day.
Yeah.
And she really, I really think about for my mom, having me was like having the kind of veil of white privilege ripped away, of suddenly, you know, sort of falling from grace, so to speak.
And there was stigma applied to her that she'd never experienced before.
Never experienced before in her life.
Mm-mm. Right.
And a kind of a, you know, there was an assumption around just being black in Montreal when I was born that there would be social instability, that there would be poverty, that there would be, you know, that I wouldn't do well in school, there were these assumptions around my identity that played into how things went as well, I think. And so when he was, you know, when this, my primary abuser, my adoptive father, when he was courting my mother, I was in foster care, and I had been removed by Child Protective Services. And so he, you know, he was the one that eventually paid for the lawyer, got me back, and they, you know, Child Protective Services, ironically, just handed me over to this man who, you know, proceeded to severely abuse and torture me for the next decade, you know. Those were my childhood circumstances. But the record really isn't about abuse. The record is actually about the journey out of abuse. The record is actually about breaking that cycle of abuse and trauma and violence. And as you very intuitively and astutely understood, it's about the chosen family or the protectors that I found.
Yeah.
Who and it's about art. You know, it's about how art for me and music for me and writing for me has been a lifeline, has saved my life. And that's not hyperbolic, you know. Persephone, my first love, saved my life. That's not hyperbolic. It's just true.
Yeah.
The community that I found and the kind of ability to transform and transmogrify trauma through art has been life-saving for me and life-giving. And I'm hooked on it to this day, you know.
Well, first of all, I mean, what can I say? I feel horribly that you went through this. I feel heartened that you've found a way to transcend it. And what I was also like, the stuff that you're just discussing comes through on the record. I appreciate your compliment towards me about being astute, but I think it's pretty clear. Like, the kudos should go to you. You've taken these life circumstances and articulated them in a way that's artful, but I get it. There's definitely undercurrents and overcurrents and things like that, but it's a beautiful mix of conveying these feelings. So first of all, let me shoot it back at you. Congratulations on that, and you should be commended. But what I was really struck by as you were talking about this situation that you were in and the people involved, your mother, your adoptive father, your abuser. You have so much empathy talking about where they are coming from. That's remarkable to me that you, did you say he was born in 1936? Like, if that's true, like, yeah. By my math and by your birth date and what you said about your mother, there's like a 26-year age difference? Yeah,
exactly. Almost 27 years.
Yeah, that's
between them.
Remarkable. Mm-hmm. I don't even understand that dynamic, but your mother sounded like she was in dire straits and needed some.
Well, I feel like she's a sibling almost. You know, I've always felt that about her because we're so close in age.
Oh, right.
You know, she was so young when she had me. And especially now as a mother, and I had my daughter when I was 33 going on 34 with, you know, a very loving partner who is the best dad and co-parent. Yeah. And, you know, I can't imagine how alone and terrified she must have been, you know. And it's as I've gotten older, I've understood, you know, my empathy for her has grown, my compassion for her has grown,
right?
You know, as I've lived more and as I understand just how terribly alone and unsupported she was.
Right. So it may have been that she was looking to him almost as a father figure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. And still, you know, she still lives with him.
Oh, he's still 1936. He's still, wow.
He's still alive.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's still alive. I charged him actually when I was 20. It took me till I was 20 years old to
in the year 2010,
charge
I believe.
Him.
Yeah. And how did
no? Oh, sorry, no. In the year 2001.
Oh, one. Sorry, I
yeah,
got
yeah. In the year vaguely, 2001.
I got vaguely dyslexic.
Thank
there.
You.
I'm sorry.
That's very sweet. I'm old.
No, sorry, I got confused.
I love that you thought I was 20.
No, we're about the same age. Sorry, I did that math wrong.
I'm 42. I'm 42.
I was calling upon. It's not in front of me, but I was calling upon what I'd read, and I just inverted the numbers. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
But anyway, you charged him, and what was the result of that? What happened?
So he went to prison for 3 years. He got he ended up pleading guilty in the end.
Oh.
And he did that because there were other women who came forward that he had abused.
So how do you, and again, I want to call back to this. I appreciate you having empathy for your mother and also the fact that she was later diagnosed with schizophrenia. Like, but this is going to be a lot for some people to comprehend. We seem to be in that place now where when someone says or does something that if it's not outright abusive, it's just the example that keeps coming up on my show is Kanye West. Here's someone that some of us used to love, but it's very difficult because of how he's behaving. And yet we know he's had trauma. He's going through mental health issues. So then there are people who are like, yeah, I get that. I get the Trump stuff. I get it. But he's my guy and he's going through shit and I need to be there for him. He's just always been my guy. So the more conversations I have like this, I'm getting the sense that people have this notion in them that you have to think of someone's circumstances before you cast judgment. This is a situation, Allison, where you're a firsthand victim. It's easy to kind of talk about the abstract with some of these cases, but how do you do that? I say that with all frankness. Like, how do you have that within you to have empathy for this person? I mean, you charged him. So there's a limit to how much empathy you had, but how do you do that? How do you look at his circumstances?
I think that charging him was empathetic.
Right.
Because it stopped him from harming more children, specifically my niece. I mean, the reason I charged him. Two things. I don't speak of myself as a victim any longer, if I ever did. I really lean into that I am a survivor. And in fact, that is part of our human birthright, is survival and resilience. That is part of our human birthright. And I think that when we have so much shame and silence around these kinds of circumstances, that compounds the harm and it enables this same endless looping, repeating intergenerational cycle of trauma and violence and abuse to perpetuate. It flourishes. These cycles of trauma and violence and abuse flourish with our silence. And I say this, I would never, ever, ever judge or fault any survivor who did not ever want to talk about it. I have deep empathy for that. I understand that. I would never shame another survivor for what they ever do or don't want to say, you know?
Yeah.
But who I am as a writer and a musician and a performer and a compulsive writer is I need to write it out, and I need to sing it out, and I need to talk it out. And so because I can, I do, because I know there are a lot of us who can't. And here's the truth. It's 1 in 3 women. It's 1 in 4 men. It's 1 in 2 trans or non-binary or gender diverse folks who have been, who have reported being abused in some way.
Yeah.
You know, sexually assaulted in some way. That's so we know that that's just the tip of the iceberg, right? Because how many people never report it?
Yeah.
So it's a pandemic. It's an ancient pandemic, so pervasive and extreme that we didn't almost even see it for so long. And it's really only since the advent, and as much as I, you know, I worry so much about like my daughter, all our kids, all the kids growing up in social media experiment land, right? Because we're just old enough that we had childhood without it, right? But we're all immersed in it now. For all of the kind of, you know, the sort of terrifying human social experiment of it, mass global social experiment of it, one thing that has become clear to me is for movements like social justice movements, survivor movements, it has been an unprecedented connector, right? Where we, Tarana Burke and the work that she's done with the Me Too Movement org, that is, it's unprecedented in our human history, actually.
But it's also, it's interesting that you invoke human history, because I think what we're getting to is the endemic and systemic nature of such abuse. I mean, in the song, in the contextualization for the song Night Flyer, I believe you invoke your ancestors and suggesting it's what you were saying earlier. Like, this is a cycle of surviving various kinds of abuse and trauma. And so I'm curious about what I can see how that would bolster you. Like, people have gone through this. Other people have gone through this. My people have gone through this. Is that why you look to that, just for that support mechanism, to know that they transcended the same things you've gone through?
I think yes, in a sense, but also this record, this solo work, you know, I've been a musician, for a professional musician, for almost 22 years. And I never in my entire life felt a desire to, in fact, I was terrified of the notion of putting myself forward under my own name as a solo artist. I've always been much happier being, you know, one part of a whole and part of a collective effort, a creative communion. You know, that's what I'm really hooked on, is creative communion with other artists and musicians that I resonate with. But what this grew out of really was when I was working on the Songs of Our Native Daughters record with Rhiannon Giddens and Layla McKella and Amethyst Kia, you know, who are brilliant artists and my chosen sisters. We were delving into a lot of the history of the Black diaspora, but from a Black woman's perspective, from our perspectives, and finding the kind of stories hidden between the lines of even a song like John Henry, you know, where we got a lot more interested in Pollyanne. She's the one who actually does his work when he's sick, and she's the one who survives, and one would assume she's the one who keeps his tale alive and keeps their children alive and keeps the generations going, you know. So we, during the process of that record, I wrote a song for my paternal, many times great matriarch, Kashiba, and I learned about her because of, you know, meeting my Grenadian Canadian family, my Black family. You know, I was raised by white supremacists. I was raised in an all white family where I constantly had to explain and justify my existence. You know, I mean, the question when I was growing up was like, where, you know, where's your family? That's your family. Why are you Black? Basically.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And, you know, I had no, and because of my adoptive father's sort of really poisonous white supremacist indoctrination, I had shame around my own Blackness,
you know,
that I had to deprogram, and I will probably be deprogramming for the rest of my life if I'm truthful, you know? And meeting my Black family was incredibly healing. We met in 2009 for the first time. I was 30 years old. And
this is in Brampton, Ontario.
Yeah. We met. Well, technically, we met at the Toronto airport.
Right.
They came and met me at the airport, July 2009. I was between festivals with Pogrom. My whole band was with me. This was in the Pogrom days. And we met. And actually, it was right before Shelter Valley Folk Fest, which is no more. I missed that one.
Oh, okay.
So it was, or soon before, you know,
because
I guess that was September, and I met them. I met them in July for the first time. We went to Grenada in August.
Oh, wow.
And then I came back to Ontario in September, and my whole family came to Shelter Valley. And I remember some of the musicians came back, and my biological father threw this incredible feast. He's, you know, made this Grenadian feast with curried goat and roti and all this delicious, amazing stuff. And I am so lucky in my paternal family and have been welcomed in. And, you know, for Ida, for my daughter, that's just her family. She's known them her whole life, you know.
Did reconciling with your, I don't know the circumstances as to why your father was out of your life for that long.
Yeah.
And I can only assume, you know, you talk about the trauma and the feelings of feeling like you were doubting, you know, your Blackness itself was giving you moments of pause or whatever. I don't know how to put it, but
well, I was shamed for it my whole life. And that reflects what's happened to the diaspora and is ongoing,
yes.
You know? And this is what I mean. It was, I connected when I wrote, when I heard Kashiba's name, it was just like this instant. I couldn't stop crying, and it was this feeling of connection, and that I understood, because what she went through, my childhood paralleled, you know, except that luckily for me, what she went through in her day, it was legal what they did to her, right? They kidnapped her and they enslaved her and they stole her children and they enslaved them. And that was legal then. That was legal, right?
Yeah.
And what I was essentially enslaved by my adoptive father for a decade, but it wasn't legal. And I was able to escape and I was able to find a path to freedom, you know, and she never got the chance to do that, but her strength and resilience sustained me through all of that. And her ability to keep hope alive, because you don't survive for that long if you can't keep hope alive. You just don't. You die. You die of despair. You kill yourself, or you jump. You know, she somehow was able to keep hope alive despite her much more severe circumstances that she had to endure, you know.
So you've encountered figures in your life, whether they're your family or figures in, let's call it, popular culture, that have inspired you and bolstered you. But you also said something earlier about how you never imagined you'd be a solo artist. And before we get to that part of it, I wonder, and I'm sure it had in some way, your experiences had in some small way, at least, informed your previous works.
Absolutely.
But is Outside Child the first time you've truly addressed what you've gone through? Or can you think of examples in your previous songwriting and artistry where you tried to delve into these feelings and address them?
Oh, it's definitely not the first time. First time I addressed it was on a Po Girl record called Vagabond Lullabies. I wrote a song called Part-Time Papa.
Right.
And that was the first time I addressed it. And then actually in right before I met my family in 2009, I wrote the song earlier, but in 2009, I recorded a song that I wrote called No Shame with Po Girl that's very explicitly addressing my childhood abuse. And I specifically did a No Shame tour. I ran a marathon that same September. So this is all as I'm meeting my Black family too. I raised money for Little Warriors, which is a wonderful organization working to end childhood sexual abuse and supporting survivors. An organization in the U.S. called the National Children's Alliance.
Right.
And so I was very, but it was, this was pre Me Too. This was pre survivors finding each other on Twitter, you know?
Right.
It was very much alone. And that tour was one of the hardest things I've done. And I had all kinds of pushback from venues that didn't want us to come back, that were angered that I was talking about this, it was the full gamut. And the other thing that happened that made me understand just the absolute ubiquitousness of this trauma was at every show, there would be multiple people disclosing to me, writing to me afterward. And it was my first time understanding how deep this goes and how just insidious, ubiquitous, it's everywhere present.
Yeah.
So many humans on the planet have been sexually abused, and it's a pandemic, you know?
Absolutely. And to your point, you mentioned pre-Me Too. So basically from that moment on, there has been some more acceptance of what you're talking about. Does that strike you as part of the motivation for you to really talk about yourself over the course of a whole record in this biographical sense? Did you feel strengthened enough to do that?
I mean, it grew out of – that is definitely part of it.
Yeah.
Understanding just the extent of it. And I feel – really strongly that nothing can change if we can't even talk about the problem to begin with, right? Nothing can change.
Yeah.
We are doomed to just perpetuate this if we can't. I mean, it became more urgent for me after having my daughter. And I actually went through our daughter was born at the very end of 2013, New Year's Eve 2013.
Yeah.
And I went through a period of lying fallow as a writer. At the time I thought of it as writer's block, but I have, I think, a better understanding of what that actually was. I was needing to deeply process, and becoming a mother for me was joyful, but it was also terrifying because of my childhood and the very difficult relationship that I have with my own mother.
Yeah.
And I was really terrified to become a mother. And I also understood when she was born that I had to get braver and louder and more actively seek to reduce the harm of the world, you know, because I have to be able to look her in the eye and say, I did everything I could to make sure that you and your generation don't have to carry the same traumatic burdens that our generation did.
It's true. Becoming a parent makes you an advocate for your child, but this sort of warrior for the planet, because that's ultimately
really
their home.
Does.
Yeah. Yeah. So that
it's their home, and we're pushing it to, we're on a precipice.
Yes.
As a species.
Or past it.
The planet will go on. Yeah. The planet will go on, but we're pushing ourselves towards our own mass extinction.
Yeah.
And it is part, these things are connected. The way that we exploit humans is connected with our extractive, exploitative process on the land. It is no coincidence that in areas where the sort of mass, short-sighted, exploitative extraction is occurring, those are also areas where women are going missing.
Yes.
You know, those are also areas, those are the highest areas of assault and abuse of indigenous women and women of color. You know, and not just women. I should say, you know, trans, all women, women included, and also men, and also non-binary folks.
Yeah.
You know, and also gender diverse folks. Like it's these things are connected. You know, and we have to. If I have a guiding principle, I suppose it's harm reduction. I want to do whatever I can to reduce harm and to increase the chances of not just survival, but thriving and joyful connection. And I believe that the beloved community is possible. I believe that we are capable of seeing and respecting one another as fully equal human beings. I believe that we can do it as a species.
I hope you're right. I'm a bit more cynical, even as a father of two, and I can't be that cynical because what the hell would I do every day? But yeah, I hope you're correct. I'm just not, you know, as we live through what we're living through right now, I'm just not seeing it as much as I'd like. I do see it. Like when I say this to my wife, she's always like, well, look at this Humans of New York story, or look at this. And I'm like, right, yeah. I know. Look at this person set a marathon record. I know there's hope, but it's hard. Do you have ever struggled with this? Yeah. I struggle every day. Okay.
I struggle with it every day. And every day I talk myself down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And say, okay, well, what can I do today to be part of creating a more sustainable, loving, compassionate, empathetic, cooperative community?
Yeah.
You know, because we cannot afford to be devaluing any minds right now or leaving any minds behind. We need to get incredibly creative. We need to think laterally and to creatively problem solve together like never before if we want to come out of our tailspin.
Yeah, I feel like on a very, very, very minor and small scale, that's what I hope on some level I'm accomplishing with doing having conversations like this one, like just keeping the chatter up on that level. Yeah. So you're talking about how after the turning point of Me Too, there was more resonance for these stories and this messaging, and people were finally, I was talking to someone on the show a few weeks ago, and her example was she had someone as a musician that was ostensibly a stalker and an abuser, a former partner who became an abusive partner, and then stalking, just showing up at the shows. And she talked about the fact that in recent years, when she used to try to talk to the security at the show to be like, please don't let this person in, they just give her like screw face. Like, what are you talking about? Right.
Right.
And now
right.
because of things like Me Too and more conversations like the ones you're having, they listen. Yeah. They are hearing it. So I don't mean to tie too fine a point on this, but as we're speaking, you've gone solo and you're resonating. You yourself and your music is resonating arguably as much as or more. Would you agree more than it has?
It's unprecedented.
Unprecedented. I didn't want to put words in your mouth or.
No, it's definitely unprecedented
right.
in my career. It's, I mean, it's surreal. You know, when the Grammy nominations came down, it was like, I thought it was a joke when JT told me, you know, I didn't believe him. I was in the middle of a podcast when he told me, and so my reaction has been captured for all time. There's a lot of yelling and swearing and laughing. You know, like, this isn't real. This can't be real.
If you can be objective about it, what do you think? I mean, you made a fantastic record, but you've made fantastic records before. I'm sure you've thought so. Others have thought so for sure. But on this level, any perspective on why this is occurring right now?
I think you're right in that it's a conjunction of things always, right? People, there's timing, there's luck, there's all of these layers. I think it's many layers. I think 2020 happened. And for the first time in my lifetime, there has been a sustained collective reckoning with white supremacy and the ongoing violent, destructive force that it is in our, globally, but specifically in the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah.
And we, particularly in Canada, have not wanted to face or acknowledge any of that. You know, we like our multicultural PR, but the reality is that the only place I've been assaulted by a police officer is Montreal, Quebec, Canada. The only place I've been spat on in the street is Montreal, Quebec, Canada during the referendum. The only place I've been refused bathroom service is Hannah, Alberta.
Right.
You know, it's in our, and we are reckoning with it in the most awful way yet, with finding more and more thousands of Indigenous children consigned to unmarked graves in our country. Like, we have to face white supremacist domestic terrorism in our country and in the U.S. And that was, you know, in 2020, it started with Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd. You know, I had been sort of quietly building a team around Outside Child. You know, I actually recorded Outside Child in 2019 between an Our Native Daughters tour and a Birds of Chicago tour in Nashville just after Americana Fest in October 2019. And I didn't really know what to do with it. You know, I, even as I was, and the reason I was able to record it was because of the Canada Council for the Arts. I got a grant, a writing grant, sort of exploratory writing and demo grant from the Canada Council for the Arts that Kaya Cater's mom, Tamara Cater, encouraged me to apply for. And I got it, and it was exactly enough money to rent Sound Emporium in Nashville for 4 days and to pay everybody to come play. And we made Outside Child in those 4 days and a fifth extra day at the producer Dan Nobler's home studio, where Yola and Ruth Moody and the McCrary sisters and Aaron Ray came, and we all sang together and did the harmonies.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the last thing that we did for the record. And I didn't know what to do with it, you know, because it was clearly a solo record, and I did not know how to do that, what to even do with it. And then I was just back on the road. And as with, you know, as we all had to, March 11th, the lockdown came here. And we were out, Birds of Chicago was out on the West Coast. We were actually supposed to be heading up to Vancouver with opening for the Wood Brothers. And the lockdown happened. We all flew home. And then, you know, the rest, as we're in it still. But that I was forced to stop for the first time in 20 years. You know, I've been a working class, hard touring, subsistence touring musician for at that point, up to that point, 20 years, you know, and it was a trap. It was a hamster wheel that I couldn't get off, you know. And we would always think, oh, this sort of the big break is coming, and the big break never came. And we were surviving. We were making a living barely, but we were not thriving, you know. And it was getting to the point of, I was really questioning if we could go on, you know, if it was sustainable, as our daughter was getting older and I was, you know, and she no longer wanted to be on the road, and she didn't want to be a homeschooled van baby, and, you know, she wanted to go to school with other kids. Yeah. And I was, you know, I actually went and got my yoga teacher training certificate thinking I was going to have to just quit music and stay home with Ida, and, you know, JT could keep touring and I would teach yoga and take my kid to school. You know, I was at a point of real despair with our career. And when the shutdown happened, that was when how close to homelessness and poverty extreme poverty that we actually were became clear to me. And what we leaned into was the fact that over these 20 years up until that point, 2 years ago, the community that we have found and that has found us and that we have created through traveling with our music, that's what saved us. Yeah. It was, you know, wealthy friends helping us out who love our music.
Yeah.
You know, it was doing online concerts and people supporting shockingly generously, you know, and being able to survive it all through it. I mean, but it made me understand how precarious our existence was. Yeah. And I just, it wasn't okay, you know? And so I leaned into what is something that we can do if all performance is removed. Well, we can still write, and there are lots of ways to use our words.
Yeah.
There are many ways to use our words. And I've only begun to scratch the surface of that. And so I really got, both JT and I just got really strategic. We found our manager during the lockdown, Carissa Stolting from Left Bank Artists, but she also runs a company called Unmanageable, which is a 501c3 that really supports artists who are on a mission beyond just an album,
right.
You know, that has a kind of a greater harm reduction, social communal element, you know. And so it started with meeting Carissa, and then it started with strategizing around, how do I even want to release this album? Who do I want to work with? And then it was a lot of taking Zoom meetings with different labels and basically being told, well, this is a very worthy project, but I don't know how we would possibly market this, you know, those kinds of conversations, you know, or, oh, well, we already have a Black artist, you know, who's sort of rootsy. So I don't know if we could. And then, And then the real reckoning in 2020 started to happen. And then suddenly we were getting all of these calls back and people interested in talking for the first time in a serious way, about the record. And then it was, you know, I had an intuition to reach out to Brandi Carlile, whom I didn't know very well at the time. We had, you know, we'd run into each other at the Edmonton Folk Fest and done some workshops together. And we'd run into each other on KAMU and things like that. But we didn't really know one another. But I so deeply admire the way that she is constantly centering community through her career.
Yeah.
You know, as with each success, she's giving back. And her Looking Out Foundation, you know, it was when the Minneapolis protests happened and so many Black activists were being jailed, Brandi, that after George Floyd, she did an online concert and she raised $100,000 and she just gave it directly to Black Visions Collective, which is a Black trans-led social justice organization in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And I was, I admire that so deeply, but it's also what we can, you know, I think about the artists who get huge platforms and it just never occurs to them to invest in community and to be mentors to the next artists coming up. It just doesn't occur to them. Like they've gotten so far inside their own bubble of yes people, I presume, that it just, they don't even see that they have this sphere of influence that they could use to reduce harm and uplift others, right? They don't even see it. But Brandi constantly sees and does that. And
she seems awesome. I've never encountered her personally, but I...
She's a really special person.
Yeah, my wife and I were just marveling at Brandi's recent Saturday Night Live appearance.
Oh, incredible, wasn't it?
One of the best ones I've ever seen. I was like, what the hell? This is so good. And
it was so good, and it was so not a gimmick.
No.
It's just a great band that have been playing together for 20 years, playing their hearts out up there and singing their hearts out.
You know, I have a tab. I have an internet tab here open where I can contact. I put it up and I'm going to contact Brandi's people and see, because I would love to talk to Brandi. I really thought that. Anyway,
she's wonderful.
Hearing you talk about it, and that sounds great. So,
and that's what I looked at her and I said, well, that's, if I'm going to do a solo career, I want it to be not like the same career as her, but that notion.
Yeah.
Of your, it is never just about self-aggrandizing, right?
Yeah.
It's about using your voice to reduce harm in all and building empathy. Like that's what music is to me. That's what arts work is.
Yeah.
It is deep, deep empathy work.
There are stories of people like Dolly Parton and Rihanna, in fact, who are like using their platforms and using their resources to help people. And quietly, often, like not really making a huge deal.
And Prince did it nonstop, and he never once spoke of it because it was against his religion to do so.
Yeah.
And it was only after he died, I think it was Van Jones who was like, "I need everybody to know this is what he did."
Yeah.
This is what you know.
No, it's heartening, and I can see you being in that lineage of people who have a generosity of spirit, and it comes through in your work. And you were talking a few moments ago about how in the midst of the pandemic and the lockdown and the music industry seeming like it was collapsing, you sought refuge or solace in the fact that you could write. And I just want to use that as a springboard to talk about, like, the lyrics here are fantastic on this record in particular, but my understanding, I think you alluded to this when we first started talking. You're working on a book of some kind. Is it a memoir?
Yes, it's a memoir. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's, I'm still in shock. It happened so fast, you know, and again, this is what you were talking, 2020 for me was building an intentional community to be able to release this work and to keep doing harm reduction work around it, basically. So when I talked to Brandi about it, she had an intuition that I should meet the folks at Fantasy Records, who had put out Tanya Tucker's last record that Brandi produced, and she was really struck by them and their ethos as a company. And she was right. You know, I met Margie Chesky, who is the head of Fantasy Stacks and Vanguard within the Concord Music family. And we just connected on a deep spirit level, you know. And they understood that I was committed, obviously, to the music, but also to forming community and coalition around harm reduction. And they are not just in support of that, they do that too as a company,
right,
you know.
Right.
And they sign people like Valerie June, and they don't think it's too much to sign two Black artists and put out their records within a few months of each other, because all of our voices are unique and needed and valid, right? You know, and I mean, I know, and this sounds like it should be obvious, but I had the, I'm not, Vish, there were these conversations where you just think, what year is it? Is it 1950? You know, would you say that? Would you say, sorry, Neil Young, Bob Dylan exists. So, you know, you've already got a singer-songwriter guy with a guitar. We don't need another. Can you imagine if that metric was applied to white boys with guitars?
It's weird because those of us in the artistic community, I think, have transcended such thinking. But then when you talk to the business people, they still have the mentality. It's really weird. Because they're in the same milieu. They're in the exact same milieu as us. They, who would be like, what the hell year is it? Whereas those folks, if you said it to them, they wouldn't they say it. They say the stuff that feels, you know, archaic.
And it sounds reasonable to them.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds reasonable to them.
Yeah.
They think it's reasonable because of tokenism and bigotry.
Yeah.
You know, like rampant tokenism and bigotry.
Yes, exactly.
It's just like, you know.
So you, this.
Finding this community, you know, and, and then it was all of us get, then it was finding, I have to give huge props to my brilliant publicists, because this record, nothing would have happened with it without them, you know, without, here in the US, it's Meg Helso. In Canada, it's Ken Beattie at Killbeat and Simon at Six Media in French Canada. And they have just done a miraculous job sort of evangelizing around this record.
Yeah.
You know, I think about so often, I think particularly for people outside of the industry, they don't understand that when they hear about a record, it doesn't mean that a record they didn't hear about wasn't worthy, right? It's like there were all of these forces that had to come together, including a brilliant publicist.
Yes, yes.
For you to hear about the record at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
So the book, the book is, I was just trying to connect what you're saying. Like, I appreciate that. You're having this amazing moment. And the book is...
Because it's connected. Yeah. So my publicist, Meg Helso, her best, one of her best friends is a literary agent named Meg Thompson. The Megs, these are the Megs I know. And it's like, I always get that like Kids in the Hall song in my head.
The Daves I know.
But it's like Megs I know. These are the Megs I know. I know. These are the Megs I know.
So pretty good to have Megs. Yeah, absolutely.
Helso. Yeah. It's really good to have Megs and Daves.
Exactly.
So Meg Helso, who's my American publicist, introduced her I guess she, I don't know, if, I don't think she even actually sent her the record, but her dear friend Meg Thompson, who's a literary agent and runs Thompson Literary Agency, heard Night Flyer on the radio and was really struck by it, and was then talking to Meg about it, and Meg Helso, and she was like, that's my artist, I work with her. And so Meg Thompson said, well, can I meet with her? Has she ever considered writing a memoir? And we had the Zoom meeting, and of course I have been... That's all I was doing throughout 2020 was just furiously writing, because that was something I could do.
Yeah, you know, like you were saying.
When we were locked down. And so I didn't know necessarily exactly that I was writing a memoir, but that is what I have been doing. And the process of meeting Meg Thompson and learning how to write a book proposal, writing my first chapter, submitting it, you know, it was such a clarifying, empowering, galvanizing process, you know. And then we had, so she sent out the proposal widely on January 3rd, and we just got all of these yeses back and took several meetings, but the meeting that I was, and the editor that I was the most, just felt the most deeply connected to, was Bryn Clark at Flatiron Books, which is an imprint within the Macmillan family of publishers. And Bryn worked actually on Tarana Burke's last book, Unbound, which is a brilliant, brilliant book that I highly recommend to everybody. And Tarana Burke is who founded the Me Too movement.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just, you know, and I was listening to her so much during 2020, during these Share the Mic campaigns. She took over Glennon Doyle's Instagram, and I was so, and had a conversation with Dr. Yaba Blay, who had taken over Abby Wambach's Instagram, and I remember just devouring these IG live conversations that Black women were having, mm-hmm. you know, throughout 2020. and feeling this sense of community and recognition and coalition in such a strong way. And so now to be at the same, you know, I actually, Toronto sent me this such a generous message of welcome to the family, and, you know, because we're working with the same editor and
that's lovely,
and publisher. So I just feel so grateful to be supported in this way as a writer, you know, and to be able to thereby support my family as well is just an extraordinary privilege that I did not imagine that I would experience in my lifetime, you know.
It sounds like an amazing turnaround from 2020 to now. And so congratulations on that. And I'm happy for you. Externally, I suppose, I don't know if this is trite or simplistic, but externally, I could see why someone might see Outside Child as being a complementary aspect to your memoir. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Well, the memoir is really growing out of it. It's like there's so much, in a way, the memoir will be kind of a companion to Outside Child, people won't have to have heard it necessarily, you know, they will have their distinct lives and identities. But definitely it's grown out of the explorations of Outside Child.
So do you have a sense, I assume they may have given you a deadline, but do you have a sense of your timeline on the memoir?
I am trying to submit a chapter a week to my editor. I'm hoping to have the first draft done sometime in late spring, early summer. And it will hopefully for a 2023 release. I'm not sure exactly when in 2023.
Okay. Well, I don't mean to pry. I'm just curious. Yeah. I'm sure it's on your mind a lot. If I had a book to write, it would be all I was thinking about.
That's,
you know,
I think about. I'm deep in it. I'm almost done with my next chapter that I'm going to submit later today.
Oh, nice. So, okay. Well, I want to let you get back to your work, but, beyond the book, you obviously have just relatively recently released this.
Yeah. Six months ago. I can't believe it's 6 months ago. Been 6 months. Like,
there are Grammy nominations.
So much has changed.
But the Grammys, I know you were a bit outspoken on Twitter about the Grammy nominations, and I feel like the ceremony has been, what happens with that nomination? I feel like the ceremony was sort of permanently postponed, if that's such a thing. Is that true?
They just announced it's going to be April 3rd in Las Vegas.
So
that's a whole, when you say outspoken, how so?
I thought I read a tweet. There was a thread, and I don't know if you were involved in it, actually, but I thought you were invoked, that there was some criticism about the nomination process. Do you have any take on the Grammys? They've faced a lot of scrutiny over the last few years.
My take is that I think they are seriously engaged in self-examination and course correction. I really appreciate that. And I'm so new. You know, this is my first go-around. I've never been nominated before. So I'm just really starting to I started getting really interested in learning about the Recording Academy in 2018 when Tina Chen led the kind of DEI inquiry had recommendations. And I thought, well, that's really proactive that they're doing that. And I know that it's been a complicated, rocky last couple of years for them, obviously. And then with the world too. But I think it's a really critical time for the Recording Academy. And I feel I've become a member and I'm really interested in being part of that DEI course correction work. I'm doing that actually now. For the first time, I threw my hat in the ring for a board. You know, I got elected onto the board of the Americana Music Association. And I subsequently started working with a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee within that. And it's been such just a healing process to be a part of. And we're just at the beginnings. There's a long way to go, but I'm really proud of our all Americana community for the work that we're actively engaged in. And especially when I look at the way that mainstream country music is having a real problem reckoning with its own biases and exclusionary practices and you know, male-centered and white supremacist practices.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're having a lot of trouble reckoning with it, and I'm really proud of the kind of greater Americana and folk communities for doing that work with real courage and vigor. And I think that the Recording Academy is trying to do the same. I saw it as a really great sign when there seems to be like a brain trust forming of saying we can't just have one person with whatever their biases are in charge of everything, right? Yeah. And I think they did away with the secret committees this year, and that was a new thing. And I know that people have different feelings about that. Some people felt that those committees actually helped prevent sort of major labels from having too much sway, and other people felt that it was, you know, the lack of transparency was a problem. You know, the Recording Academy right now is at 11,000 members, and each member can put forward two other artists that they think should join. And I love thinking about how quickly things can actually change if we get engaged, you know, as a community. And if we each take responsibility as an artist and a member of a community, what kind of community do we want to have?
Yeah.
Do we want to have a community that reflects the full spectrum of amazing art out there so that it's relevant and a true peer review? Because I love the notion of a peer, like science is peer reviewed. I love the notion of an artistic peer review, essentially, of an artistic coalition, because it's not about, to me, the Grammys isn't about competition at all. It's about community. Yeah. Like on the surface, it's, oh, only one person can win this symbolic award. But to me, what's really exciting are the nominations.
Yeah.
And so to be nominated meant something to me, and it means something to me. It is, I do take it as a great honor, because for all of the, no organization is without flaw.
Yeah.
And obviously the Grammys has been struggling.
Yeah.
But I really encourage artists to get in there and be the change. You know, how does anything change if we don't step up and be the change we want to see, right?
I mean, I really appreciate your articulation of this and also for clarifying what I thought maybe was conveyed. That's great. And I think you're absolutely correct. And so I also just wish you the best of luck with that. It is a huge honor. It could be a life-changing thing. It is probably already a life-changing thing.
It's already life-changing. Yeah. It's already life-changing. And it's reflected. And this is the other thing that I feel the need to just say something about. There's been a lot of high-profile artists that I respect and admire their careers who walked through that magic door many years ago, right? Of being nominated, of being honored, who are now sort of saying things like it's all corrupt, burn it all down.
I'm not going to submit my records anymore. But they've said literally, I'm no longer going to submit my records for consideration because they think it's so flawed. And they're high profile artists, and I mean the likes of Jay-Z have said this The Weeknd recently. But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Drake as well. Yeah. And I guess not that I think my words are going to reach them, but I would ask them to really think back. To remember what it was like when they were outside of the magic circle and they're struggling as artists, and that getting nominated is a stamp of validity as an artist.
Yeah.
Whether it should be or not, we could argue about hierarchical notions of value and you know, if we're going to do that, we have to start taking apart our entire everything about our systems, right? So I am someone who still believes that we can create change within the systems that exist and better them and transform them thereby. I still believe that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's naive. But I see the changes that are already happening in just within the Americana Music Association and the Americana music community and how significant that is. And it is significant. It's Valerie June and Yola staying at the top of the charts for months on end when they used to not play women, let alone black women, right? Like that's real change that reflects in tour ticket sales, that reflects in, you know, album sales, that reflects in that's a big deal, right? And getting nominated for a Grammy, what I will say for three Grammys in this case, already the fees that my booking agent is able to get have gone up.
Yeah, yeah.
Like no. That translates to me being able to support my child.
Yes.
It is a tangible difference
yeah.
from when I wasn't nominated or recognized by the Academy and now when I am.
Yeah.
And so what I want to say is to those artists who are industries unto themselves now, you know, like Drake is an industry. What percentage of Toronto tourism is
yes.
Drake related,
yep.
you know, and that's an incredible, amazing achievement. But there was a time when that nomination or that win was transformative for him
yes,
too
yes.
as an artist,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I guess what I would say is I hope that these artists who are industries unto themselves can remember what it was like to be struggling
yeah.
and to be outside of these magic circles. And rather than saying we're going to shut that door so no other artist can ever come through. You know, it's kind of like you're in the magic room eating the chocolate fondue and you're going, actually, it's really messed up in here. Like they're not, I got less fondue than that other guy.
Yeah.
So you don't want to come in here at all. You don't want to come in here at all. It's just, there's a not really remembering or seeing the full picture of it. There's a privilege, right, to that sort of like blow it all up. Who cares? They don't need it anyway. You know,
well,
the weekend doesn't need the Grammys.
I hope people hear you on this because you know, where you're coming from, the perspective is so valid and necessary because what you've transcended in your life and survived in your life, I think some people can wallow in the despondency of that experience. And you're an example of someone whose hope, I think, is really bolstered by what you've overcome. And so you see things yeah, from a perspective definitely. Of like, you think that's bad? You know, like think of what
it could be a lot
think
worse.
Think of what people have survived, and you know,
yes,
you're belly aching about not getting a Grammy nomination, so you're taking your ball and going home. Like I do,
but I never want to shame anybody, but I do think someone like The Weeknd is so power and Drake.
Yeah.
You know, the artists like who have become industries unto themselves have such a massive sphere of influence, and I guess that's all I would say is. I would encourage artists and it doesn't matter where you are. I had a sphere of influence when it was 20 people coming to my house concert. That was my sphere
yeah,
of influence,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And now it's growing. Yeah. And that was just as valid. I don't feel ashamed of when I was sleeping on floors yeah. in order to make the tour happen and pay my band. I don't feel ashamed of any of that. I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the way we created a niche for ourselves when nobody wanted to hear it. What I was, you know, when the mainstream world couldn't hear my writing and didn't want
yeah,
to, you
yeah.
know, and that's okay. There were always people that did want to hear it. And that was my sphere of influence,
yeah, yeah.
right? And it's growing now because for whatever reason, these doors are opening
yeah.
now, you know, and the Grammy nominations are part of it. Those are three big doors that just opened for me as an artist. And I'm still experiencing the benefits of that. You know,
well, great.
And I would just encourage artists with even bigger platforms to think about, I have this sphere of influence. What can I do with this to give back to my community?
Yeah.
What can I do with it to help other artists who are coming up and who are facing some of the same systemic barriers that I faced?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How can I change it?
Yeah.
I just think about if The Weeknd and Drake got involved and leaned into that and got on the board of the Grammys and got on, they could do all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they could make change.
Yeah.
They could be part of changing it for the better, to make it work better for other, you know, intersectional artists coming up.
Well, life can be long. Know? And I think as they're still trying to represent themselves as very young artists. So as they get older and settle into their mature years, maybe they'll do that more. And I know,
yeah.
I'm sure they're doing some of what you're talking about in the background already.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah. I know
yeah.
they rep Toronto
sure they
pretty.
And again,
pretty
no shade.
No, it's not shade.
Them.
No shade.
Yeah.
Not shade. It's just
yeah.
pointing out some facts. Where I was
yeah.
going to go with the fact that you've got the book that you need to work on today. So we're going to let you go soon. But secondly, have you pondered songs beyond these ones?
Yes.
Are you writing? Are you recording? Are you in that zone?
Yes, I'm writing. I'm not recording yet. But I think in May, I'll probably start doing some demoing for the next record. And I am writing, and it's been really freeing to kind of have the world of Outside Child living on that album and now living in this book as well, like where I can continue to kind of excavate and go deeper there, but to be freed musically, to not have to be in that world anymore musically
has
actually been really joyful. So, I'm really excited about the next record for sure.
Excellent. So Allison, if people want to learn more about you, this record, Outside Child, anything else you want them to know, can they follow you? Where would you like them to go?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I would say I'm most active on Instagram and Twitter. But my website, you know, is a great place, like a kind of everything is there. The links to all the various socials are there. And that's just AllisonRussellMusic.com.
Okay.
And so I'm
everywhere.
You know, on all the usual places, but I would say that I interact the most on Instagram and Twitter.
So I get that a lot. People are mostly doing stuff on those two things. So, okay. Yeah. Sounds good. Now, if we can go out on a song from Outside Child, I wonder if you can choose one and maybe just tell us why it came to mind.
I think Poison Arrow, because for me, that's in a way one of the most hopeful songs on the record. And it's really about like reclaiming my city of Montreal, because there were a lot of years where I was almost afraid to go back because it, you know, just the memories were painful. And for a long time, my abuser was still there. He lives in St. Catharines now. So that was sort of, that song came out of realizing going back with my partner and our daughter that like I could feel the joy of my city again. And I felt just at home, and I felt the distance of how far I'd come from when I was, you know, a scared runaway kid.
Right.
And the kind of, it's bittersweet, but it's also, I don't know, I just felt a gratitude. And it's in both French and English, which is sort of how my memory works. And it's just that notion of sometimes that little drop of poison can become medicine, make you stronger.
Well, that was wonderfully put. Before we get to it, are you, I take it you're bilingual? Are you?
I was completely bilingual as a kid. I would say that I am struggling to keep my French because I've been living in English places, but I am I'm definitely still bilingual, but my French is no longer as good as my English.
my kids are in French immersion, so I just want to know what they're in for.
Oh, that's great. I went to all French immersion too. Yeah. I think it's wonderful, and it's you never lose out by learning another language. It is always a benefit. And it's helped me so much when I've traveled, you know, in other romantic language countries like Italy or Spain, anywhere, you know, I can understand so much.
There's similarities between the languages. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I won the French award in grade 8, but it's gone downhill since then.
Ah, that's so great.
I need it back. I know. I'm trying
You can relearn with your kids.
I'm trying.
And practice with them.
They're even resisting their own French. It's interesting. They're at that age. But anyway, I appreciate this conversation, and I appreciate this song pick. We're going to play Poison Arrow from the breakthrough and Grammy nominated album, Outside Child. Allison, this was really, really a pleasure for me, and you're a very inspiring person. I hope you enjoyed it, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thank you so much, Vish. It's lovely talking to you.
Kind to me, and I'll be kind to you. It's not just your poison, it's the bolt, the stray, shaft and feather too. The rush of the wind, the blue sky bird, the rain that soaked the ground. Only in the love. Go in peace, be not afraid. Roll me easy, namaste. Are you sad and broken, traveler? home. Poison arrow broke in my chest, but I'm in my family. Le divan, boulevard Saint-Laurent. Sipping dry sherry. The sun is bleeding slow. She dies in pink and blue. It is on the radio, singing trust in me and I do. Go in peace, peace, not afraid. Rolling easy, namaste. Are you sad and broken travelers? Come on. Je te souhaite l'acceptance. Je te souhaite une deuxième chance. Et le cœur d'un enfant. Routier, routier, chantez, chantez. L'heure des miracles est arrivée. Le poison peut être médecin. Si t'en bois une goutte seulement. Go in peace, peace, not afraid. Roll them easy, namaste. Are you sad and broken travelers? Come on. Go in peace, peace, not afraid. Roll them easy, namaste. Are you sad and broken travelers?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Very, very special thanks again to Allison Russell for appearing on this, the 668th episode of Creative Control. It was very nice to reconnect with Allison after all this time. And yeah, again, thank you so much, Allison, for being on this episode of Creative Control. Creative Control is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at vishkana. You can also visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon once you've made your donation and I'll get you one while supplies last. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and place special orders at via their website, blackbird.ca. And also to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. If you happen to be in either of those cities, check out those businesses. They're great. Tell them I sent you. See what they'll just look at you like, who? Maybe they won't. I don't know who. I haven't been there in so long. Maybe they remember me. I have no idea. Thanks, as always, to Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. Jim lives in Ontario as well, so if you see Jim, you know, mention my name, see what he says. He'll probably act like he doesn't know me, but he does. We're friends. He might say we're not, but we are. He knows me. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode of this show with the wonderful and inspiring Alison Russell. I was very moved by this conversation, and her record, Outside Child, is wonderful. So I hope you will check out Alison's stuff if you're unfamiliar. And if you are here because of Alison, I hope you will consider subscribing to this podcast and following it and telling your friends about it, and maybe they'll do the same thing and spread the word about it. That would be cool if you can do it, but if you can't and don't want to, that's fine too. You can do whatever you want. You're your own person. Anyway, I'll talk to you very soon. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.